This CLE is based on the decisions released in July of 2019 by our appellate courts that dealt with issues related to negligence. The decision summaries that are the basis of this CLE were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in July of 2019 and subsequently collected in a update pamphlet. And it's that update pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this course. And the page numbers that I mention in the recorded session are the page numbers of that pamphlet. The first case is on page 6, the Jean-Paul case. It just deals with the need to disclose a lawsuit, a negligence suit, as an asset in bankruptcy. The second department held that plaintiff didn't have the legal capacity to sue in this slip and fall case because the action wasn't listed as an asset in a prior bankruptcy proceeding. The court said, the failure of a party to disclose a cause of action as an asset in a prior bankruptcy proceeding, which the party knew or should have known existed at the time of the proceeding, deprives him or her of the legal capacity to sue subsequently on that cause of action. Next, on pages 6 and 7, is the Katan case, K-A-T-A-N. It's a case against the state, slip and fall case. Therefore, it was brought in the Court of Claims. And it deals with the requirements for a notice of claim under the Court of Claims Act, Section 11. The third department held that the claimant in this slip and fall case did not meet the pleading requirements of Court of Claims Act, Section 11. And her claim was therefore properly dismissed. The court wrote, Court of Claims Act, Section 11B, provides that the claim shall state the place where such claim arose. Although absolute exactness is not required, a claimant must provide a sufficiently detailed description of the particulars of the claim to enable defendant to investigate and promptly ascertain the existence and extent of its liability. Defendant is not required to ferret out or assemble information that Court of Claims Act Section 11B obligates the claimant to allege, and failure to abide by the statute's pleading requirements constitutes a jurisdictional defect requiring dismissal of the claim, even though this may be a harsh result. Here, the location of the slip and fall was not laid out in the claim sufficiently. Then, in opposition to the defendant's motion to dismiss, the claimant submitted an aerial map of where she allegedly fell. But the court held, the aerial map does not cure the pleading defect because the aerial map was not included in her claim, and the defendant is not required to go beyond the claim to ascertain the place of injury. Next, on page 7, it's ADG versus Children's Ark Daycare Center. It's a negligent supervision case. Apparently the child in daycare was injured while in daycare. The facts are not described, but the issue was whether the plaintiff had alleged sufficient facts to raise an inference that the child was injured because of the defendant's negligence. So in that regard, the court wrote, a plaintiff is not required to exclude every other possible cause, but need only offer evidence from which proximate cause may be reasonably inferred. The plaintiff's burden of proof on this issue is satisfied if the possibility of another explanation for the event is sufficiently remote or technical to enable the jury to reach its verdict based not upon speculation, but upon the logical inferences to be drawn from the evidence. And the court went on, the defendant's submissions failed to negate a reasonable inference that the injury occurred at the defendant's daycare center and that the defendant failed to provide adequate supervision. Next on page 8 is another negligent supervision case. Happened at school, where one student pushed another student. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the school district's motion for summary judgment should have been granted because negligent supervision was not the proximate cause of the injury. The court wrote, where an accident occurs in so short a span of time that even the most intense supervision could not have prevented it, lack of supervision is not the proximate cause of the injury, and summary judgment in favor of a defendant charged with the duty of reasonable supervision is warranted. Next on pages 8 and 9, the Etzion case. It's a legal malpractice case, and it deals with the issue of continuous representation and whether the statute of limitations was told by continuous representation. The First Department held that the continuous representation doctrine did not apply and the legal malpractice action was time-barred. Plaintiff was represented by the defendant law firm in a 2005 divorce. Plaintiff's ex-wife then sued plaintiff alleging he fraudulently concealed an asset in the divorce proceedings. The defendant law firm successfully defended the fraud action. 12 years after the divorce action ended, plaintiff sued the law firm for malpractice, asking to be relieved of the obligation to pay the law firm's legal fees in the fraud action. The court wrote, the motion court correctly found that this action, which was commenced 12 years after the divorce action ended, is barred by the applicable 3-year statute of limitations. Contrary to plaintiff's contentions, the continuous representation doctrine is inapplicable because defendants were retained under 2 separately executed retainer agreements in the divorce action and the fraud action. The first retainer agreement expressly stated that it did not cover any services following the entry of a final judgment of divorce. Thus, there was no mutual understanding that further representation was necessary on the specific subject matter of the malpractice claim. Moreover, the divorce action and the fraud action, although related, were 2 distinct and separate actions. Next is the Leader case, pages 9 and 10. It's another legal malpractice case raising the continuous representation issue. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the plaintiff had raised a question of fact about whether the continuous representation doctrine told the statute of limitations. The attorney had attempted to remedy the failure to file objections in an estate matter after the statute had run. The court wrote, it's well settled that in order for the continuous representation doctrine to apply, there must be clear indicia of an ongoing, continuous, developing, and dependent relationship between the client and the attorney, which often includes an attempt by the attorney to rectify an alleged act of malpractice. Here, plaintiff submitted evidence that defendant made several unsuccessful attempts to file the objections within the weeks after the deadline, and that he made preparations to appear at a scheduled conference on the objections. Those efforts could be viewed as attempts by the attorney to rectify an alleged act of malpractice, and thus plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact whether the statute of limitations was told by the continuous representation doctrine. Next is the Greenberg case on pages 10 and 11. It's a medical malpractice case, and the issue that came up in that case had to do with the advocate witness role. The attorney was representing his mother's estate in this medical malpractice action, and he was going to be a witness in the case. So the question was whether he should be disqualified under the advocate witness rule. The court wrote, "The advocate witness rules contained in the rules of professional conduct provide guidance but are not binding authority for the courts in determining whether a party's attorney should be disqualified during litigation. Rule 3.7A of the Rules of Professional Conduct provides that, in general, a lawyer shall not act as advocate before a tribunal in a matter in which the lawyer is likely to be a witness on a significant issue of fact. There's an exception to this rule when disqualification of the lawyer would work substantial hardship on the client. Further, the advocate witness rule generally does not control where the attorney is also a litigant. However, estate representatives represent the interests of the estate's beneficiaries rather than their own. Therefore, generally the advocate witness rule will prevail over a fiduciary attorney's right to self-representation." Here, the other distributee affirmed that his interests in the lawsuit are identical to those of the plaintiff, whom he wished would remain as attorney for the estate. Accordingly, while the plaintiff is not a party in his individual capacity, his personal property interests as one of the two distributees of the estate are at stake, and his interests appear to be identical to those of the estate. Furthermore, the plaintiff affirmed that his attempt to retain different counsel for the estate was unsuccessful, such that his disqualification as counsel would essentially foreclose the claim, working substantial hardship on the estate and its distributees. Next is the Angel Howe case on pages 11 and 12. It's a medical malpractice action, and it brings up the continuous treatment doctrine. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the action based upon a 2005 thyroid surgery by the same doctor who performed the 2010 thyroid surgery was time-barred. The two surgeries were discrete events, and the statute of limitations was not told by the continuous treatment doctrine. The court wrote, "It is undisputed that plaintiff did not treat with Dr. Chaffee in relation to the 2005 surgery after her final follow-up in 2005, and that she didn't return to Dr. Chaffee until 2010. The surgical procedures in 2005 and 2010 were discrete and complete events that cannot be linked by way of the continuous treatment doctrine, and there was no evidence of anticipated further treatment related to the 2005 procedure at the time plaintiff left Dr. Chaffee's care in 2005. Next is another medical malpractice case on page 12, C.H. versus Dolcart. And the issue here has to do with whether an evidentiary ruling can be appealed during the course of the trial, or whether it must wait until the trial is over, and the court laid out the criteria for that decision. Third Department held that the defendant doctor could not appeal the denial of defendant's motion to limit the expert testimony which plaintiff could offer at trial in this med mal action. The motion court's ruling did not limit the issues to be tried, therefore an appeal must be brought after trial. Court wrote, "It's well settled that an order which merely determines the admissibility of evidence, even when made in advance of trial on motion papers, constitutes at best an advisory opinion, which is neither appealable as of right nor by permission. Therefore, appellate review of the court's ruling must await the conclusion of the trial, so that the relevance of the proffered evidence and the effect of the court's ruling with respect thereto can be assessed in the context of the record as a whole. A Accordingly, this appeal must be dismissed. Next is the Noel B. case on pages 12 and 13. It's another Med-Mal case. It has to do with whether statements made in connection with a hospital's quality assurance investigation were privileged. Fourth Department, reversing the Supreme Court and refusing to follow the Second Department, held that certain statements made in connection with the hospital's quality assurance investigation were privileged pursuant to the education law and public health law, and therefore were not subject to discovery. The court wrote, "The New York State education law shields from disclosure the proceedings and the records relating to performance of a medical or a quality assurance review function or participation in a medical and dental malpractice prevention program. Although there is an exception to that privilege, the exception is narrow and is limited to statements made by any person in attendance at such a quality assurance meeting who is a party to an action or proceeding, the subject matter of which was reviewed at the meeting." Here, the statements at issues were provided shortly after the incident and were obtained as part of the hospital's quality assurance investigation. The statements were not made at a quality assurance committee meeting, nor were they made in response to any inquiries initiated by the committee. None of the defendants appeared at any committee meeting, and therefore the exception did not apply in that case, and the statements were privileged. At this point, I'm going to insert the code word that should be put on your attorney affirmation for this July 2019 negligence update CLE. The code word is privilege. Again, the code word for this July 2019 negligence update CLE is privilege. Next is the Gilmore case on pages 13 and 14. It's another Med-Mal case, and it's a proximate cause case, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Plaintiff's expert's affirmation concerning the alleged malpractice was deemed conclusory and therefore didn't raise a question of fact. The informed consent cause of action was dismissed because the medical procedure was not the proximate cause of the claimed injuries. The court wrote, "To establish a cause of action to recover damages based on lack of informed consent, a plaintiff must prove, one, that the person providing the professional treatment failed to disclose alternatives thereto and failed to inform the patient of reasonably foreseeable risks associated with the treatment and the alternatives that a reasonable medical practitioner would have disclosed in the same circumstances. Two, that a reasonably prudent patient in the same position would not have undergone the treatment if he or she had been fully informed. And three, that the lack of informed consent is a proximate cause of the injury. The third element is construed to mean that the actual procedure performed for which there was no informed consent must have been a proximate cause of the injury. Here, the defendants established through their expert affirmation that the surgery performed did not proximately cause the injured plaintiff's claimed injuries." Next is the matter of Velez. It's on pages 14 and 15. It's a slip and fall subway accident. It brings up issues related to the municipal law notice of claim, and it brings up issues related to the judge's powers. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that Supreme Court should not have sua sponte granted relief which wasn't requested by a party. Petitioner allegedly was injured trying to board a subway train. Before filing a notice of claim, petitioner started a CPLR 3102C proceeding to obtain discovery before starting the action. The court granted the petition and sua sponte gave the petitioner permission to amend the notice of claim, which hadn't yet been filed. The Second Department noted that a sua sponte order is not appealable, but it exercised its discretion and granted leave to appeal. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 2214A, an order to show cause must state the relief demanded and the grounds therefor. However, the court may grant relief that is warranted by the facts plainly appearing on the papers on both sides, if the relief granted is not too dramatically unlike the relief sought, the proof offered supports it, and there's no prejudice to any party. Here, the Supreme Court strayed from this principle when, in addition to granting, in effect, that branch of the petition which was for an order preserving material related to the accident, it also, sua sponte, granted a nearly unlimited prospective right to the petitioner to amend a notice of claim that hadn't yet been served. The sua sponte relief was dramatically different from the pre-action discovery that was the subject of the petition. Furthermore, the papers before the court did not support the award of such additional relief, since the absence of a notice of claim rendered it impossible to determine whether the future notice of claim or any amendments would be in compliance with General Municipal Law Section 50E. Next is the Ryabchenko case on pages 15 and 16. It's another case involving the municipal law, notice of claim, another slip and fall. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion to amend her notice of claim shouldn't have been granted. The motion was made 2 years after the complaint was filed and included a new theory of causation. The court said, a timely served notice of claim alleged in relevant part that the steps and or stairs were defective, uneven, misleveled, smooth, with a slick surface, and that the New York City Transit Authority and the Metropolitan Transportation Authority were negligent in the ownership, operation, control, and maintenance of the stairs. The plaintiff subsequently filed a complaint alleging in relevant part that her injuries were caused by the defendant's negligence in the ownership, operation, management, maintenance, care, and custody of the premises. More than 2 years later, the plaintiff moved, pursuant to General Municipal Law 50E subsection 6, for leave to amend her notice of claim to remove any mention of the stairs being uneven, misleveled, or smooth, or with a slick surface, and to add new allegations that the stairs were defectively installed and or designed with a hole slash gap upon which the plaintiff's foot was caused to trip and fall. A notice of claim may be amended only to correct good faith and non-prejudicial technical mistakes, omissions, or defects, not to substantively change the nature of the claim or the theory of liability. Amendments of a substantive nature are not within the purview of General Municipal Law Section 50-E, Subdivision 6. Next is the Conn case, CONN, pages 17 and 18. It's another municipal law case involving a notice of claim. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the complaint against the municipal defendants could not be amended to assert a derivative cause of action by plaintiff's decedent's mother. The court said, the notices of claim filed against the city and the Port Authority were limited to allegations that, as a result of the accident, the decedent was caused to sustain damages related to his personal injuries, loss of earnings, pain and suffering, and medical expenses. Marilyn, decedent's mother, was not identified as a claimant in the caption of the notices of claim. She was not mentioned in the text of the notices of claim, and there were no allegations that she individually sustained any damages for which compensation was sought from the city or Port Authority. Next is the Hull case, H-U-L-L. It's on page 18. It's a negligent entrustment case. The third department held there was a question of fact whether defendant building contractor negligently entrusted a scissors lift to the plaintiff, who was injured when the lift tipped over. The court said, given the testimony regarding plaintiff's alleged lack of experience operating the scissors lift, the alleged observations by defendant's employees of plaintiff's operation of the lift, the defendant's project superintendent's assumption as to plaintiff's level of training, and his subsequent knowledge that an employee of defendant was allegedly made aware prior to the accident that plaintiff was not familiar with or trained in the use and operation of the scissors lift, we find that defendant failed to meet its prima facie burden of establishing the absence of a triable issue of fact, specifically as to whether defendant knew or should have known that plaintiff lacked the requisite training and experience necessary to safely operate the scissors lift at the time it was entrusted to him, rendering his subsequent use of it unreasonably dangerous. Next is the Meneer case, M-E-N-E-A-R, on page 19. It's a products liability case. The plaintiff was a bus driver who was attempting to fill the bus with diesel fuel, and she was sprayed with diesel fuel. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held that the product's liability cause of action against the manufacturer of the gas pump, the manufacturer was named Husky, and the premises liability cause of action against the gas station, which was Quick Fill, should have been dismissed. Again, the plaintiff was sprayed with diesel fuel as she attempted to fill the tank in the bus, which was manufactured by Coach. There was evidence that the design of the fuel system of the bus may have been the cause. The court wrote, in opposition to Husky's motion, that's the manufacturer of the gas pump, the Coach defendant submitted the affidavit of an expert and the deposition testimony of the vice president of engineering of defendant Motor Coach Industries. The expert opined that the accident was caused by a nozzle malfunction. He did not, however, identify any particular defect in the nozzle, which he did not inspect. We thus conclude that the expert's opinion is based on mere speculation and is insufficient to raise an issue of fact. It is undisputed that Quick Fill, that's the gas station, hired an outside vendor that regularly inspected and serviced their fuel pumps, and in support of their motion, the Quick Fill defendant submitted evidence establishing that the vendor determined that the fuel pumps were working properly before and after the accident, thus establishing that the Quick Fill defendants maintained their property in a reasonably safe condition. Next is the Samuels case on page 20. It's an assumption of the risk case involving a plaintiff playing basketball. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the assumption of the risk doctrine did not entitle defendant Jim to summary judgment. That's the Jim, G-Y-M. Plaintiff was playing basketball when he allegedly slipped and fell on an accumulation of dust on the indoor court. The court wrote, defendant failed to establish that accumulated dust on an indoor basketball court is inherent in the sport of basketball, nor did defendant establish that the alleged condition was an open and obvious one. Next is the Karpel case, K-A-R-P-L, on pages 20 and 21, another slip and fall case. It has to do with the concepts of a trivial defect and an open and obvious defect. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall should not have been granted. Plaintiff was jogging when she tripped over a raised edge of a depression in the roadway. The defect was surrounded by orange markings. The court wrote, the evidence demonstrated that defendant was in the process of restoring the excavated area in the location of the plaintiff's accident, and that the alleged defective condition measured approximately 4 feet wide, 8 feet long, and at least 1 inch deep. A condition that is ordinarily apparent to a person making reasonable use of his or her senses may be rendered a trap for the unwary, where the condition is obscured or the plaintiff is distracted. Furthermore, proof that a dangerous condition is open and obvious does not preclude a finding of liability, but is relevant to the issue of the plaintiff's comparative negligence. Thus, to obtain summary judgment, a defendant must establish that a condition was both open and obvious and, as a matter of law, was not inherently dangerous. Here, the defendants failed to establish that the alleged defect was open and obvious and not inherently dangerous, given the surrounding circumstances at the time of the accident. Finally, the doctrine of primary assumption of risk is inapplicable to this action. Next is the DeFay case, another slip and fall case on page 22. First Department held that the defendant, the New York City Transit Authority's motion for summary judgment, was properly denied. Plaintiff was let off at a bus stop about 7 or 8 feet from the curb and stepped into a pothole. The court said, the record shows that the bus stopped 7 or 8 feet from the curb adjacent to the bus stop with a pothole into which plaintiff fell in the path that passengers would take walking from the sidewalk to board the bus. The fact that approximately 10 other passengers safely boarded the bus at the same time that plaintiff fell in the hole while attempting to board does not entitle the Transit Authority to summary judgment. Next is the Davis case on pages 22 and 23. It's a third-party assault case. Second Department held that the facts supported a finding that the hotel, the defendant hotel, Howard Johnson, where plaintiff's decedent was stabbed to death, was negligent as a matter of law. There was an extensive history of criminal acts, including assaults at the hotel, and there was no security on the night of the stabbing. Court wrote, a possessor of real property is under a duty to maintain reasonable security measures to protect those lawfully on the premises from reasonably foreseeable criminal acts of third parties. This includes the common law duty to take minimal precautions to protect tenants and visitors from foreseeable harm, including foreseeable criminal conduct by a third person. To establish foreseeability, there's no requirement that the past experience of criminal activity be of the same type as that to which the plaintiff was subjected, but the criminal conduct at issue must be shown to be reasonably predictable based upon prior occurrences of the same or similar criminal activity at a location sufficiently proximate to the subject location. The duty to employ protective measures arises when it's shown that the possessor of the property either knows or has reason to know from past experience that there is a likelihood of conduct on the part of third persons, which is likely to endanger the safety of a visitor. Next, on pages 23 and 24, is the Brown case. It's a common carrier case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact about whether the bus on which plaintiff was a passenger stopped in an unusual and violent way, injuring her. The court said, to prevail on a cause of action alleging that a common carrier was negligent in stopping a bus, a plaintiff must prove that the stop was unusual and violent rather than merely one of the sort of jerks and jolts commonly experienced in city bus travel. Moreover, a plaintiff may not satisfy the burden of proof merely by characterizing the stop as unusual and violent. However, in seeking summary judgment dismissing such a cause of action, common carriers have the burden of establishing that the stop was not unusual and violent. According to plaintiff's testimony, shortly after she paid her fare, the bus took off and then came to a quick stop, causing her to fall. According to the testimony of the bus driver, he was operating the bus at about 15 miles per hour when a vehicle cut in front of him, causing him to apply the brakes and stop the bus. Under the circumstances, a triable issue of fact exist as to whether the stop of the bus was unusual and violent. Next is the Brooks case, which is on pages 24 and 25. It deals with an evidentiary issue in a traffic accident case. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this case, traffic accident case, should have been granted. There was sharply conflicting testimony about how the accident happened and whether defendant fled the scene. A witness, Stephen, who allegedly chased defendant down after the accident, was not allowed to testify that defendant appeared to be intoxicated. The court prohibited Stephen from testifying about his observations of defendant on the ground that he was not an expert in signs of intoxication. Contrary to the court's ruling, it's well settled that a lay witness may testify regarding his or her observation that another individual exhibited signs of intoxication, and also regarding his or her opinion that another individual was intoxicated. Plaintiffs should have been permitted to present Stephen's testimony with respect to whether defendant appeared to be intoxicated, which would allow the jury to consider whether and to what degree alcohol impaired defendant's senses and his her ability to accurately perceive and recall the events about which she testified at trial. Defendant testified that she did not fumble with her license, her speech was not slurred, she did not recall her eyes being glassy, and there was no alcohol on her breath. Thus, the excluded testimony from Stephen would have provided evidence in denial of some affirmative fact which defendant had tried to prove, and therefore fell within the scope of permissible rebuttal evidence. Next is Castro on page 25. It's an interesting case in that the appellate court found that evidence was incredible as a matter of law. First Department, over an extensive dissent, found that defendant's motion for summary judgment in this traffic accident case was properly granted. The majority argued plaintiff's testimony was incredible and therefore was properly disregarded. The dissent argued plaintiff's testimony raised classic questions of fact about how the accident happened. The collision occurred when plaintiff was attempting to change lanes. The majority interpreted plaintiff's testimony to mean that she was straddling two lanes and was not moving when the truck struck her SUV, which, based on photographic evidence, the majority found incredible as a matter of law. The court wrote, "In summary judgment analysis, we must discount the plaintiff's testimony where the plaintiff has relied solely on her own testimony, uncorroborated by any other witnesses or evidence, and her testimony belied common sense. As these circumstances are presented in this case, plaintiff's testimony was properly disregarded as being without evidentiary value." Next is the Delmore Incorporated case on page 27. It's a traffic accident case and it deals with spoliation. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the destruction of plaintiff's truck, which was allegedly struck by defendant's truck, warranted striking the complaint. The court said, on their motion pursuant to CPLR 3126 to strike the complaint, the defendants sustained their burden of establishing that the plaintiff was obligated to preserve the truck at the time it was purportedly seized and disposed of, that the truck had been seized and disposed of before the defendants had an opportunity to inspect it, and that the truck was relevant to the litigation. Furthermore, the defendants demonstrated that their ability to prove their defense had been significantly, if not fatally, compromised by the loss of the truck. Under the circumstances, the sanction of striking the complaint was appropriate. And the last case in this July 2019 negligence CLE, it's on pages 27 and 28. It's the Gilkerson case. It's another traffic accident case dealing with the emergency doctrine. The Fourth Department held that the defendant did not eliminate questions of fact in this traffic accident case about whether the emergency doctrine applied. Defendant was behind plaintiff's motorcycle when a vehicle operated by Buck ran a stop sign, broadsided a truck operated by Matthew, which then collided with the motorcycle. There was evidence defendant's vehicle then struck the motorcycle. Defendant testified she saw the Buck vehicle approaching the stop sign and thought it was going too fast to stop. The Fourth Department held there was a question of fact whether defendant should have slowed down at that point. The court wrote, "We conclude that issues of fact exist whether defendant, in taking no evasive action and in making no effort to slow down or move over or otherwise attempt to avert the impending collision, responded reasonably under the circumstances." So that concludes this CLE, about 40 minutes, based on the decisions addressing issues in negligence that were released by our appellate courts in July of 2019.